This is the current federal tax developments for the week of December the 31st, 2018. Current federal tax developments are brought to you this week by Kaplan Professional Education and by your state society of CPAs. We have a busy week here to end the year in 2018. Surprising with the government shutdown in place, but there's a lot in the pipeline and a lot came down for us to talk about. We'll start with a court case here where a loan advisor ended up who was found not liable after repay a loan, discovered that nevertheless it was going to be taxed as ordinary income. The IRS dramatically raises the limits on vehicle costs eligible for the cents per mile and fleet average valuation rules. The IRS issued a safe harbor that may upset some people who have been looking at maybe thinking that they knew a workaround from the clarification the IRS issued on the charitable contribution state tax credit rules that were discussed earlier this year. Going to turn out that maybe that whole trade or business thing doesn't quite work as well as you might have hoped. We'll have a revenue procedure that was issued to deal with the ADS issues for electing farms and real property businesses. An IRS publication raises the alarm that potentially real estate agents, real estate brokers, insurance agents, and insurance brokers might be in a specified service trade or business, despite the proposed regulations indicating that those entities were not specified service trade or businesses. We'll talk about what that may tell us about what's in the final regulations. We have proposed regulations on treating the sale partnership interest as effectively connected to a U.S. trade or business. The IRS also announced a plan to issue regulations on two special enforcement matters under CPAR, as well as we discussed last week, the comprehensive partnership audit regulations are in final form and out now. And finally, we'll talk about the IRS's annual disclosure revenue procedure that was updated this year. So lots actually happening this week, surprisingly enough. You have to assume if the government shutdown continues that we're going to at some point run into a week where we don't have a whole lot to talk about, but this is not that week yet. We still have a bunch of things going on. I want to welcome you all into 2019 here. Sure, most of you will be listening to this after the year has changed over 2019. I want to wish you a happy year here from Kaplan Professional Education, as well as from the state societies that we work with in this area. And remember, we're getting ready for a tax season here. So yeah, it's time to start worrying about all of our continuing education. Let's talk about the first case of the week, which is Connell versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2018-213. It was issued on December the 27th. This is a case of a taxpayer who switched from one brokerage firm to another as a financial advisor. He was with Smith Barney. At the time that it became apparent Smith Barney was going to be acquired by Morgan Stanley, he decided he didn't want to stay around for that. He went out and sought alternative employment. Merrill Lynch made an offer. He went ahead and accepted that offer with Merrill Lynch. As part of that arrangement, Merrill Lynch agreed to loan him over $3.6 million and also to pay him what's called monthly transition compensation. Now, what monthly transition compensation is, was actually a payment of about $43,000 a month, which just happened to be perfectly the repayment due every month on the loan from Merrill Lynch. It also would run for exactly the term necessary to repay that loan that Merrill Lynch had given him. We discussed these in the past a couple of years ago. We discussed a case where the tax court judge deciding the case was a little concerned that this sounded to him a lot like something that probably should be taxable at the time it was issued, because it certainly seemed like this was a claim of right situation where you had unfettered access to the money that you might conceivably have to repay. But in reality, as long as you kept working, you wouldn't have to. But that wasn't discussed this time. In fact, at this time, the court mentioned that this is a fairly normal arrangement in the stock brokerage community or in the financial advisor community. And basically, you know, they didn't worry about what the tax was then. But what happened in this case was less than a year after he moved over to Merrill Lynch, things began to go sour between him and Merrill Lynch. And what happened was Merrill Lynch began looking at, claimed to be looking at, some issues about his conduct related to information he'd brought over from Smith Barney. There were all kinds of back and forth on this. Merrill Lynch's outside counsel actually recommended merely a censure, you know, saying that, you know, comment in his personnel file, but leave it alone. That wasn't where it ended, though. Merrill Lynch continued to push, and they basically forced him to resign. Now, he resigned under pressure. After resigning under pressure, Merrill Lynch went after him for the remainder balance of the note. You know, we only had 1 year of the note basically in there. Of course, this became a problem. He basically filed an appeal with FINRA. His complaint was, as he said, that he was being forced out. He was actually saying they violated his contract. He noted that what really happened in this case is because they also refused to issue timely. You know, they first refused to issue on a timely basis the Form U-5 Uniform Termination Notice for Security Industry Registration with FINRA, which he noted until that was filed, saying why he had left Merrill Lynch, or Merrill Lynch's story about why he had left Merrill Lynch, no other organization would touch him. And then when they finally did file that note, they basically put what would be kind of a non-flattering comment in there, stating that effectively, you know, he had, you know, basically been terminated, or he had been allowed to resign for reasons, you know, related to the fact that they'd lost confidence in him due to issues with how he had violated the rules regarding, you know, handling data from his prior employment. Based on all of that, he said, look, I just simply cannot actually get into this industry. And that was important because he had brought a pretty big book of business with him. And the issue was, you know, as soon as he resigned, Merrill Lynch had the rest of his staff who stayed on and were retained at Merrill Lynch, which, by the way, he argued was an argument about why, look, if this was such bad conduct, these people were all involved in this, how come all of them stayed around? He said what they really were trying to do was get my customers for nothing. And he said and they prevent me from competing to make sure that I can't turn around and take those customers with me. So basically he sued in with FINRA. FINRA did eventually decide after listening to the back and forth and going through this, that in fact, he didn't owe the debt. Merrill Lynch, you know, they found that Merrill Lynch had violated the contract, at least to the extent that he should no longer be required to pay back the loan. So he's not paying back the loan anymore, which is fine. But now the problem is he's got this, you know, huge amount of cancellation of debt income. And he took the position that, wait, well, you know, what Merrill Lynch really did, they were after my book of business. They bought my book of business. And because they bought my book of business, this should be taxable as a long-term capital gain. Because what I really did was sold my book of business to Merrill Lynch. Well, the tax court said, okay, we have to look at this a little different. FINRA, in their arbitration award, didn't really say why they had paid it to you. Did they believe that Merrill Lynch was essentially buying the book of business, and that was the deal? So what they gave you was to compensate you for that lost book of business, or was it a violation simply of an employment contract, in which case this represented ordinary income that should be recognized in the future, that now you're going to be paid in one lump sum, so you'll recognize it all today. And the tax court said, well, since FINRA hadn't said, we have to look at your pleadings. And as is often the case, a good attorney who's trying to get something for his client is going to bring forth every possible claim there is. And they noted that while, in fact, they did talk about this, you know, stealing of clients and purchasing client relationships, you know, they also spent time in this, in their pleadings, talking about the fact that Merrill Lynch had violated the contract, that due to that contract violation, that's part of the reason why he shouldn't have to repay the loan. And the tax court said, look, fundamentally, the burden is on you, taxpayer, to prove why this debt was, you know, why this loan was forgiven. And the IRS position that, look, it was ordinary income, it was just compensation, it was amount you would have recognized ordinary income had you stayed there, you already were reporting it that way, saying that's presumed to be right unless you can show clearly that it was a sale of a capital asset. The court said you hadn't carried that burden, and because of that, we have to consider this ordinary income. Next up, quick issue here. Notice 2019-08 issued on December 21st. Something some of you may have noticed this year was we did not get a notice early in 2018 telling us what the values were for 2018 limits, vehicle values, for taxpayers who use the cents per mile method for determining the value of a vehicle that would be included, the amount of amount you put employees W-2 for personal use of a vehicle under certain special rules, or the fleet valuation rule. And normally that's published very early in the year. Well, the IRS had been holding back on it this year. And the reason is because of changes made in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which substantially increased the amount of luxury auto limitations. And what the IRS decided was that they're going to substantially increase these amounts in play for this purpose. Both figures are now set at $50,000, which is a substantial increase in value for 2018. So if you're using the cents per mile method or the fleet valuation rule in your business, now vehicles up to $50,000 in value at the beginning of the year can be used, can be valued under that method. Interesting aside, it just took a while to get this out this year, but we now have it out. And as I say, it's gone up substantially. Next up, something that I think is going to cause some problems here in Arizona is this new revenue procedure 2019-12, issued on December 28th of 2018. This clarifies earlier clarification about the state tax credits that you could get for making charitable contributions. Now, you may all remember, this has gotten been talked about all year. We've had this as the limit workarounds on the $10,000 state local tax deduction limitations, or SALT limits, or as you refer to them. And that you could do this if you made a charitable contribution to a charity or to the state, depending upon which program we're talking about here. And the state would give you a tax credit equal to a large percentage of that contribution. In Arizona, that large percentage was 100%. And the issue was, can you deduct that as a charitable contribution? And we ignore the fact the state is forgiving that much income tax for you, or do we have to reduce that value under a quid pro quo contribution? Well, the IRS issued proposed regs earlier this year that told us if you made a contribution and you got more than 15% value as a credit, more than 15% of the value of what you gave as a credit on your state tax return, then you had to reduce the contribution by that state tax benefit. However, they later came out and said, wait, but you know what? If a trade or business makes such a payment, and it's for legitimate business reasons under Section 162, then in fact, this whole rule about charitable contributions doesn't apply. Well, that caused some people to say, hey, wait a minute, that's great. I can just run this contribution through my S corporation. And actually, Arizona had a credit that was perfectly set up for this anyway, where S corporations could make unlimited contributions to private school tuition organizations. Now, there was a total limit statewide, so you were bidding for an $83 million pool, but if you got a part of that pool that you got into, and you weren't really bidding, you were just trying to file ahead of everybody else, ask for it ahead of everybody else, you essentially got an unlimited amount you could offset, and you could make that payment. You'd make the payment to the tuition organization. You then would get a credit on your state return equal to what you paid tuition organization. And you did that as an S corporation. It was like, hey, this is wonderful. You know, I owe $200,000 of Arizona tax. I'm going to make this $200,000 contribution, and that'll be a charitable contribution on Schedule A. And I will be able to then, you know, get that full benefit, even though my Arizona tax will go down by $200,000. So I'm not going to have to worry about the cap of $10,000. Okay, not so quick. Now we have this Reb Proc that talks about the issue. If the entity making this contribution is a C Corp, then things are pretty straightforward. One question we had, under the rules we've had previously in the regulations, if I make a charitable contribution from my business and I claim it's for trade or business reasons, then I have to have an expectation of a return at least equal to what I gave to the charity. Well, in this case, there's a presumed direct benefit. And the issue is because if, in fact, I make this contribution and I get the money back, let's say, and even if it's 80%, then I just need to show that I'm going to have a reason to expect a benefit for the remaining 20% of my contribution, a much smaller number. In Arizona, it's basically by default with 100% the credits that there's presumed to be a benefit at least equal to the contribution. And if we do that, we don't reduce the expense on the 162 promotional expense. However, promotional, whatever you're going to call this expense, advertising. But as they point out, this is going to reduce your state income taxes, which be deductible anyway. So there's no real net change. Now, where it gets messier is when we talk about pass-throughs. If you have an S corporation, a partnership, or a sole proprietorship, all of them are going to be covered by this. You have to have a qualifying pass-through. And one of the key problems for a qualifying pass-through is that it turns out the tax you get a credit for cannot be an income tax. That's kind of a big little thing they neglected to mention in the clarification this summer. So what that says is if, like what we talk about here in Arizona, I make a $200,000 contribution to a private school tuition organization, I have a business reason for doing so. And I've got this $200,000 benefit, and I've been promoting the heck out of this. Now, suddenly we come back and say, well, because it's an income tax, you got to reduce that $200,000 trade or business expense by the $200,000 charitable contribution, by $200,000 credit Arizona's giving you. Because we're saying, hey, that's still the same workaround. And what's really interesting about this is it tells us the effective date of this is January 1st of 2018. Well, that's interesting because the effective date of proposed regs was actually August 27th, payments after August 27th, but this goes back to January 1st. That raised an interesting question, by the way, very real here in Arizona, because those credit payments for the school, for the S corporations, they were all paid in the middle of the summer before August 27th. So now there's a real question as to how this works. Now, as is noted, it is a safe harbor. They're not saying you might not get a benefit otherwise, but it seems unlikely. In any event, interesting problem. So if you were betting a lot on that whole trader business bailing us out, may not work as well as you thought it was going to work. At least not the way the IRS made it seem simple. Next up, Revenue Procedure 2019-08. This is a clarification revenue procedure issued on December the 21st of 2018. And this particular revenue procedure deals with a number of issues that relate to depreciation under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And one of the first things it does, and mainly it deals with real properties and farm, is what it deals with here. But it does tell us properties that are eligible for 179, it's qualified improvement property, and yes, that does include even this year when it's 39-year property. You can still get the 179 on that if you otherwise qualify, as well as a roof, heating and ventilation, and air conditioning equipment, fire protection or alarm system or security system that are placed in service after the commercial building is initially placed in service. All of these qualify for Section 179 deductions. That's expected. That's nothing that unusual we've got. It does have confirmation about those qualified improvement properties getting 179 treatment as long as you didn't buy too much. That's going to be the biggest hitch we have with this. It's not really going to bail out somebody like Walmart, who, you know, has way more in terms of qualified business in these qualified improvement properties they spent on this year than the 179 limit, so it doesn't really matter. They're not going to be able to make up things. They're still looking for the retail fix to get in the law, something that, by the way, we can pretty much say at this point, it's not happening before this Congress adjourns. Yes, I know, in theory, they're coming in Monday to have a very quick session, but that session is going to be there, gone, and by the way, done that when we get, they get back, the next time they come in, it'll be the new Congress, not the old one, that's in place. So yeah, pretty much we can get rid of this whole, you know, all the stuff that's coming out of Ways and Means is going to be restarted because we're going to have a change in party control. So yeah, we're not going much of anywhere there. Now, the other thing they talked about here is what about ADS depreciation? First thing is we did add a brand new 30-year ADS life table. That's because if we have basically residential rental property now, the ADS life goes from 40 years to 30 years. On commercial property, we go from 50 years to 40 years. So already had a 40-year table. We now have a brand new one there. That's important because if you are a qualified real property business and you're electing out of, trying to protect yourself from not having to get it with 163J interest limitations, you have to go and switch all of your property over to the ADS tax life. Well, the issue in this case becomes interesting. They said in your change in method for ADS depreciation methods, the first thing is it applies to all property if it's elected. That was also made very clear. So these new ADS lives apply to all property if they are elected. So if you elect, you have to restate everything to ADS. But the interesting aside is it's treated as a change in use. Under the change in use rules under the regs, we do not go back and recalculate our depreciation as if we've been doing ADS from the beginning, which would be a change in method. Rather, as a change in use, we merely change how we recover the remaining life of the property under the new life period. That makes it much simpler. There's no catch up here. It will slow down other depreciation, it'll slow down your depreciation in general, but not nearly as badly as things would have been had they decided that was a full-blown change of method that required a 41A adjustment, then it would have been a lot more interesting call on what do you do about making that election if you're trying to get out of the interest limitation rules. Next up, not really good news. IRS draft publication 535 came out on December 19th. And what was noted this week, we had a Twitter conversation about this week. And this Twitter conversation actually came up. Stephen Nelson, CPA of Seattle, basically pointed out that there was an interesting surprise sitting in this publication. Now, normally we don't worry about publications because, hey, they're not binding, right? It's like, hey, you're told that, don't worry about that. They're not binding. But in this case, something interesting here. The proposed regulations told us the following businesses were not specified service trader businesses. They were real estate agents and brokers, were not specified service trader businesses. They were not in the brokerage business, and neither were insurance agents and brokers in the brokerage trader business. After that happened, obviously the IRS took comments in. They wrote final regs. They sent those final regs on to the Office of Information and Regulatory and the Regulatory I forget what it is right now, OIRA, the agency that goes over that stuff for the regulatory affairs, I guess. And the issue is they're studying these final regs. But now a few days after they sent them on to OIRA, the IRS issued these pages from Draft Publication 535. Draft Publication 535 changed the language and tells us now that brokerage services includes real estate agents and brokers, insurance agents and brokers, and intellectual property brokers. Now, the proposed reg said nothing about intellectual property brokers one way or the other, but it said clearly that real estate agents and brokers and insurance agents and brokers were not specified service trader businesses. The real concern we have is, look, if the final regs actually say what the proposed regs said, then the publication's in error. And hey, publications do not override regulations, so there'd be no problem. But you have to suspect the author of the publication did not just decide out of the blue to randomly go off script. And instead of copying what he basically been almost copying word for word from the proposed regulations, what was included specified service trader business. And this publication is meant to help people, you know, fill out those worksheets and be, you know, deal with specified service trader businesses. I have a feeling maybe he or she was working from those proposed regs we're not yet able to see. And that's really the concern. Do these reflect the changes in the final regulations? My gut tells me it's almost certain they do, that that's where this came from, that even though we have not seen the final regs yet, because of course they're still at OMB, we nevertheless now have a pretty good clue about a major change we're going to find in those regs. One piece of good news, as long as we make it to Tuesday morning without those regs being published in the Federal Register, they wouldn't take effect until publication. And by the way, at this point, there's no way they make it to the Federal Register on, you know, basically on Monday morning, because the IRS would normally release them for pre-publication, and it takes a few days to get them in. And the regulations very clearly state they're not effective until they're published in the Federal Register. I expect we'll have the option to use the final regs if we want to, but the good news, at least temporarily, is it appears to me that real estate agents and brokers and insurance agents and brokers should be able to rely on the proposed regs for 2018 returns. So they'll get their 20%, even if they're over the threshold amounts and the phase out range. But for 2019, I think they better be below the threshold amount in order to be able to claim the full 20%. Otherwise, they now appear to be specified service trader businesses. Keep your eye on the final regs. We're still watching for those. Who knows when they're coming out? But this is not a good sign that this publication changed this. And as I say, a lot of people I've talked to strongly suspect that this means the final regs are going to tell us these people are in specified service trader businesses. What will be very interesting to see the IRS explanation for why they changed their mind on this issue. Next up, we have more proposed regs. Regs 113-604-18 issued on December 20th. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act made a couple of changes that relate to foreign partners. One of them said that, you know, a foreign partner that sells their interest has effectively connected income on the sale of that interest. That was meant to overcome the tax court's decision in the case of Grecian Mining versus Commissioner, which was tax court decision 149 TC number 3. The proposed regulation, and then they also added a provision requiring withholding by a buyer whenever they purchase a partnership interest, unless the seller certifies to the buyer that he or she is not a foreign partner. Now, that particular rule has been held in abeyance, waiting on regulations if it's a publicly traded partnership. But by the way, it's not been held in abeyance for any partnership that's not publicly traded. And by the way, there's no exception here for a small partnership. In theory, if you don't have something from the other party stating that they're not a foreign entity, you're going to need to have them to certify that fact. If they don't, then theoretically you're supposed to withhold 10% of what you pay them. And if you don't, the partnership can be ordered to withhold that amount from your distributions and send that to the IRS. These regulations only, though, deal with the effectively connected rules. They don't talk with us about the buyer of an interest. And basically, they talk there, and there are details there. If you have a foreign partner who is selling their interest, they have the details there about how this gain is limited by the inside gain to be generated and how you calculate that inside gain versus outside gain and come up with a properly effectively connected number it's going to treat as from a U.S. trade or business. If you want to do that, if you need to do that, this regulation right now gives you the guidance. It can be relied upon for now in this computation, probably had to be used this tax season for anybody who has that sale. But at least we have the guidance out. Obviously, again, the IRS is requesting, as always, comments on the regs. Now we have Treasury Decision 9844 issued December 21st, 2018, and Notice 2019-6 issued on December the 20th, 2018, just before the final decision. That Treasury Decision 9844, the final regulations have been issued by the IRS on the centralized partnership audit regime. Nothing huge was changed in those final regulations. There is one thing that talks about you can no longer have a notice of inconsistent treatment once the IRS has notified the partnership of the fact that they're under exam. That is somewhat new, was not in the proposed regs. If it impacts people, we'll see. There's some discussion about whether that would be valid, you know, whether the law really mandated that impact. And if it didn't, whether the IRS can really sneak that in a change in the final regulations the way they appear to have done so. But other than that, pretty minor changes from the proposed regulations, nothing really huge. That notice issued the day before told us there are two things which they're going to issue more guidance on and need to worry about is. In the technical corrections that were passed as part of the Budget Act back in March, the IRS was given some options to write special enforcement exceptions to these rules. And what the IRS tells us that is, they're going to write in two sections. Number one, there's going to be a basic exemption from the CPAR rules written if there's an examined person other than a partnership, which triggers a change in a partnership item. They're going to write special regs on how that's handled. And they also have special rules they're going to write on a qualified subchapter S corporation as a partner. They're going to say under the current rules, basically, normally you can't opt out if you have a Q sub partner, even though the Q sub partner, you know, is 100% owned by an S corp, which by itself, the S corp being an eligible partner, and maybe the partnership could do the opt out. Well, they're going to come up with a system under which a Q sub can make an agreement that will allow the opt out to take place. But again, that's going to be part of this to be issued future guidance as to how a Q sub, an S corporation with a Q sub, could make that election. Finally, we have Revenue Procedure 2019-9, issued on December the 20th, 2018. This is IRS's annual revenue procedure on disclosure, proper disclosure on a tax return. Again, proper disclosure protects the taxpayer from the IRS assertion of a substantial understatement penalty, as long as if the position did not have substantial authority, but has at least a reasonable basis, and you know it is properly disclosed. The same rule applies to the preparer penalties under 6694. If there's an assessment of tax and the position on the return did not have substantial authority, but it did have a reasonable basis, again, disclosure on the return, proper disclosure, would protect the preparer from that penalty. The question becomes, how do we do that? There were only minor editing changes from the prior year's version of the form. So there's no, of this procedure. Nothing really huge went on and changed this year. Normally, proper disclosure, unless there is a different rule provided in this Reg Proc, requires filing a Form A275, Form A275R with the return. Now, this is going to be really important this year because, as I've mentioned before, the 199 Cap A rules include a provision that state if you claim even a dollar of 199 Cap A deduction on the return, the level at which the substantial understatement penalty applies drops from 10% to 5% of the proper amount of income, proper amount of tax to be shown on the return. Now the the $5,000 limit, the $5,000 base doesn't change. So you have to have at least a $5,000 change. But that means though that with a $5,000 change, it used to be that up to $95,000, basically we were you could have a $95,000 tax on the return. Turns out it should have been $100,001. That $5,001 change would not have been a substantial understatement. Now, unfortunately, it is a substantial understatement because that'd be greater than 5% of the tax properly shown on the return. Consider this year about having to do those A275s. And again, nothing in the rate in the rules on 199 Cap A suggests that that penalty is limited to 199 Cap A issues. So you need to be a little careful in that regard. Well, it's now your last chance to sign up for your State Society CP courses. Again, it's January coming up, and we know tax season is running. Now, those of you in A&A, yeah, there will be some things offered during, March or February and March, but you guys are in the middle usually of those of you who are not A&A are generally around financial statements and audits that require people to start, getting things together. So you don't tend to have a lot of extra time in that range either. Before busy season gets going, this is your last chance. Be sure to check your State Society catalogs. Again, we are expect those final regs at some point, so keep an eye out for courses that will be added on the final regs when they show up under 199 Cap A. And check other things that you can ready yourself for. The CPAR regs are out, so partnership courses can actually talk to you about what those rules really are at this point. We've also had, we've had guidance come out on some of the other issues with the whole Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. The guidance here on the interest limitation, 163J, is out. So there's lots of neat new things that have happened the last month or so that maybe setting up a January course is not a bad idea. Take a look at what your State Society offers in their catalogs, see what's available. I know that we're also doing sessions, that are like those broadcasts. A lot of the states use the Cal CPA broadcast systems. If you have access to those, I'll point out I'm going to actually be doing on January 15th, I'm going to be broadcasting my session. We're talking about partnership and S corporation basis. So if you want to sign up for that, it'll be there. By the way, warning, some state societies show that as being taught by somebody else. Turns out that person was unable to handle the engagement this year, was able to produce the product. So I end up stepping in. So I've got that there. So if I'm not listed there on the January 15th, but it's partnership and S corporation basis, yeah, that's the course from Cal CPA. And so I'll be standing by to answer questions on that one. And we'll also then be doing the broadcast that day. There are two choices that day. One starts at 6:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. One starts at 6:30 a.m. I should say Pacific Standard Time. One starts at 8:30 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. So, hey, you got a couple of choices there. And again, a lot of the state societies use the Cal CPA systems. So you might check and see if your state society is involved in that. If they are, they may very well be listed in their catalog. You sign up for that one. We got other courses coming along. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments again for the week of December the 31st. You can catch me regular updates at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. Been posting things there as they happen. If you have any questions or comments, my email address, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I do post on Twitter. There it's @edzollers. You can also follow my discussions on the subreddit, TaxPros. That's at reddit.com/r/taxpros. I also follow discussions online, New Jersey Society of CPAs on their Connect site, the Minnesota Society of CPAs Connect site, Arizona Society of CPAs Connect site, and I also follow along somewhat on what goes on in Cal CPAs Tax Talk. So you can check out any of those useful discussion places where CPAs will talk to you about tax issues. Otherwise, hopefully things slow down a little bit now. It's like if we don't keep accelerating. And I hope you had a good new year. Hope you had an enjoyable 2018. Look forward to a Well, it'll be at least an interesting 2019 this tax season. We'll sort of see how it works out. And we look forward to talking to you next week as we'll bring up the next session of current federal tax developments.